complicated black lung disease is fatal. Research shows there's an epidemic of the disease in Appalachia.
If the regulatory system had been working, it shouldn't have happened.
I'm Kara Holsapple. Today on the Allegheny Front, we'll hear how this epidemic has impacted a coal miner who lives with this form of the disease. And more people work in energy efficiency than in any other segment of the clean energy economy.
I really enjoy being able to see the difference that I'm making.
Plus, a school groundskeeper in California was awarded $80 million from an herbicide manufacturer because the chemical contributed to his cancer. So why is glyphosate still being sprayed at school properties all over Pennsylvania?
Weed control can be done physically, not through chemicals.
Those and more stories about labor with an environmental focus for this Labor Day weekend are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Remember the explosion of a pipeline in Beaver County last September? Authorities said heavy rain caused a landslide leading to the explosion, which destroyed a house. Recently, the State Department of Environmental Protection pulled the Beaver County Conservation District's pipeline permitting authority after reviewing their erosion program. It found problems with the district's record keeping, training, and inspections. Well, at a public meeting on Wednesday, the leaders of the conservation district said DEP should have let the local agency keep its responsibility over erosion control permits, which are needed to build big pipelines. The conservation district said DEP mainly found clerical errors, which it says it's correcting. Josh Eisenfeld of Fair Shake Environmental Legal Services says the influx of pipelines in Pennsylvania is straining the ability of local regulators to review them.
What we're seeing right now is that these conservation districts are not equipped to handle, and they're, you know, maybe hiring staff just to handle these things, and those staff members are learning as they go.
Environmental groups want a six-month pause on all permits in Beaver County until DEP reviews those approved by the district. A lawsuit filed in federal court in Pittsburgh on August 26 alleges U.S. Steel withheld required emissions data after a Christmas Eve fire knocked out pollution controls at the company's Clairton Coke Works. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports.
From December until April, the Clairton plant operated without pollution controls. During that time, U.S. Steel did report how much sulfur dioxide the company was releasing to local regulators. But two environmental groups say the company should have been doing more. They say it was obligated to release data on other hazardous air pollutants, including known human carcinogens. Adam Crone is an attorney with the Environmental Integrity Project. He says that the thousands of Allegheny County residents who complained about air quality during the outage ought to be able to know what they were breathing.
They felt faint walking to the bus stop and had to sit down, or, you know, just had increased bouts of, difficulty breathing or, dizziness. They don't know exactly what's causing that, and they deserve that information.
The lawsuit is asking U.S. Steel to release the information. The company declined comment. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
A common but controversial herbicide is sprayed on school grounds across Pennsylvania to kill weeds. But a group of concerned parents and others in Pittsburgh are raising questions about its use. The Allegheny Front's Andy Kubis has more.
Lisa McDonald and her 7-year-old son, Finn, spend most weekends playing on the playground at Pittsburgh Montessori. It's a public magnet school in the city. Finn likes to play basketball and maybe pick a few things from the school garden.
We found, like, things over that way that were, like, yellow. And we found some that were, like, the size of a pea, which were not ripe.
But on a recent visit in early August, Lisa and Finn noticed something that caused them to make other plans.
I was rather startled to see a sign stating that the school grounds were going to be sprayed with an herbicide.
The notice explains that glyphosate would be sprayed, or was sprayed, it's not entirely clear because the date wasn't legible, on the school property. Playground, flower beds, lawn, parking lot, sidewalks, all the boxes on the notice are checked. The sign also warns people to stay away for several hours, but the exact times aren't clear. State law requires school districts to post signage at least 3 days before and 2 days after each planned treatment and, quote, an area of common access where individuals are likely to view the sign.
What bothered me even more is that as we walked around the school, it occurred to me that there are 5 other entrances that are accessible to the public and that none of those had signage posted.
Glyphosate is the most widely used weed killer in the country. In 2015, the World Health Organization determined that it was probably carcinogenic to humans. The US EPA disagrees. In a review process last April, the agency ruled that it does not pose a public health risk when used as directed. But a month before, a federal jury ordered Monsanto, which makes the chemical, to pay a school groundskeeper in California $80 million in damages after finding that Roundup, the brand name of the product, was a substantial factor in causing his cancer. Ebony Pugh, a spokesperson for Pittsburgh Public Schools, says that 2 people certified by the state monitor how and where glyphosate is sprayed in the district.
So we only use the product in the summer, and it's not widely used. It's only used in roughly less than half of the buildings that we have, and we'll do it before students come back.
It turns out that the herbicide was never used at Pittsburgh Montessori. It rained that day. But the posted notice was enough to get a lot of parents and neighbors concerned. And Michelle Nakarati-Chapkis says they should be. She works for the advocacy group Healthy Schools PA, which educates parents and schools about health hazards.
We know that glyphosate actually adsorbs to the soil, so it actually binds to it. So if the kid is playing in soil and putting that into their mouth in any way, shape, or form, they're certainly exposing themselves.
At a recent back-to-school night at Pittsburgh Montessori, word spread among parents about the use of the chemical. Sean Carroll has a kindergartner at the school.
Weed control can be done physically, not through chemicals. Not just at schools, but like throughout our world, right? And am I against spraying at our school? Sure, I'm against spraying basically anywhere.
Carroll is one of more than 700 people who have signed an online petition asking Pittsburgh Public Schools to stop using glyphosate. Spokesperson Ebony Pugh says they have tried other treatments like vinegar solutions, but they didn't work very well. Pugh says the district is listening to parents, and they're considering ending the use of glyphosate at their schools. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Andy Cubis.
This Labor Day weekend, we're going back to some of our stories about people who work in jobs that impact the environment. This next story is about how one of those jobs impacted its workers. Earlier this year, we featured a multi-year investigation by NPR and the PBS program Frontline, which identified a tragic and recent outbreak of the advanced stage of black lung disease, known as complicated black lung. The investigation found that the federal government could have done something about it, but didn't. The lead reporter for that story was Howard Berkus. He just retired from NPR. He and his team spent years investigating black lung disease and found that 2,000 miners suffered from the advanced form of the disease in 5 states from 2011 to 2016. A federal monitoring program reported just 99 cases. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier talked with Berkus about this investigation, and here's some of that conversation.
What is complicated black lung disease?
Complicated black lung is an advanced stage of the disease. Basically, the stages are judged by how big the sections of damaged lung tissue are and how widespread they are in the lungs. And the lungs get damaged by the presence of coal dust, or in the case of advanced disease, complicated black lung, we're really talking about exposure to silica dust, which is 20 times more toxic than coal dust alone. And silica dust is very easily inhaled. The particles are quite small and they're sharp. So when they're inhaled, they remain in the lungs forever. The lungs fight back by building up fibrotic tissue. That tissue continues to grow and grow and essentially makes the lung useless. One pulmonologist we spoke with described it as suffocating while alive.
And just so people are aware, is there any cure or treatment?
There is no cure. It is fatal. Either the miner will die from advanced black lung disease or from something else that is triggered by the disease, perhaps getting pneumonia or some other organ failure.
So this disease is increasing in Appalachia, but you guys looked at some of the data of coal dust inside these mines. What did you guys find?
You know, I had been looking at the occurrence of what we now know to be an epidemic of advanced black lung for a couple of years, and I'd been wondering, how could this happen if the regulatory system that was supposed to protect these miners had been working? It shouldn't have happened. So I decided to take a look at some data that shows how often miners were exposed to excessive amounts of silica dust. And I looked at silica dust in particular because that is what appears to be connected to advanced black lung disease. What we found is that there were 21,000 instances in the last 30 years of excessive silica dust exposure while miners were working. And even after the Mine Safety and Health Administration applied a formula that they used to reduce the exposure to silica dust, requiring the mine to actually take action, there were still 9,000 instances of excessive exposure. So this to me showed that the regulatory system didn't protect miners in thousands and thousands and thousands of instances, and that could explain the disease that we're seeing today, which not only is epidemic, but we're also seeing the largest clusters of complicated black lung that have ever been identified.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, this disease outbreak is really concentrated in Appalachia, Pennsylvania, down to sort of Kentucky. And it's because the coal seams that miners are digging into are thinner and they're cutting into more rock, resulting in more silica?
I think that explains it in central Appalachia in particular. There's something else that's going on too. We found that a lot of miners who worked as roof bolters, you know, they're drilling into solid rock to basically pin the roof of the mine to keep it, you know, stable, to keep it from falling, to keep rock from peeling off. And even though there's a system that is supposed to draw away the dust before it reaches their mouths, the first times that they turn on their drills, they can be hit with these bursts of rock dust, which is basically, you know, quartz and silica. But also the system that collects the dust draws it into what's called a dust box, and miners have to clean out the dust box. And miner after miner after miner who worked as roof bolters told us that the process of cleaning out those dust boxes exposed them to bursts of silica dust.
And you spoke with a man who had that exact job in Pennsylvania in mines in Somerset and Westmoreland counties, which are just east of Pittsburgh. His name is Bernard Carlson.
No matter how you filter, no matter what they filter, the fine stuff is what gets in there and cuts you up.
What can you tell us about him?
Bernard worked 41 years underground at five different mines in southwestern Pennsylvania. He described getting bursts of rock dust while roof bolting and while cleaning out the dust box.
The roof bolt operator in those years was getting the majority of the dust of anybody that's underground, especially the silica dust from drilling into the roof. Because every time he lifted his jack, stab jack, to move over to put the other bolt in, there was a plume of dust coming out. Whenever you would lift yours, same thing would happen.
He worked 8 to 12 hours a day, 5 to 6 days a week, a lot of long hours. And that's another factor in this reoccurrence of disease and so much disease, is that miners have worked many, many, many more hours in the last 10 or 20 years than they used to. So they had more exposure while they were working, and certainly Bernard is an example of that.
The coal industry is different to most industries because they have the right to say, hey, this is your schedule, it's a mandatory overtime schedule, and boom, you got to do it.
Let's talk about the federal government's response to this. MSHA, the Mine Safety and Health Administration, is in charge of protecting workers. How have they regulated silica?
The law requires regulation of both overall coal mine dust and exposure to quartz or silica. The problem is that the regulation of silica dust exposure is not direct. If there is excessive silica dust detected, the regulatory response is to require the mine to lower the overall coal mine dust exposure, with the thinking being that if you do that, you then lower the exposure to silica. And our review of data kept by the Mine Safety and Health Administration shows that that did not work 9,000 times. Also in the going back to 1974, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health said that the limit on silica was not tough enough and urged federal regulators to make it twice as tough as it is and has been all these years. And then again in the 1990s, NIOSH again repeated that recommendation and also said you need to control silica directly. You can't do it through this indirect formula. It's not working. And the Labor Department had its own advisory committee on black lung disease, and that committee said the same thing in 1996. You've got to control silica directly, and the silica limit needs to be twice as tough. None of that ever happened. It didn't happen in the Clinton administration. There was an attempt to do it. The mining industry resisted. There were other challenges that the agency faced at the time. Also at the time, by the way, the agency noticed a cluster of advanced lung disease among coal miners in West Virginia, sent out an advisory to mining companies across the country. You've got to pay attention to silica. This is, you know, more than 20 years ago. And it didn't happen in any administration since. Then in the Obama administration, there was this effort to tackle coal mine dust, but any specific attention to silica was left out of the reforms that were enacted during the Obama administration.
Why?
You know, we posed that question to Joe Main, who was the head of the Mine Safety Agency during the Obama administration and was responsible for, you know, this big push to control coal mine dust and end black lung disease. And he said, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats, meaning that, you know, that he was still relying on this formula that had failed so much in the past.
This formula that lumped all coal dust as the same, even though silica is much deadlier than coal dust.
That's exactly right. And it's not a one-to-one relationship. You know, you might reduce the overall mine dust, but it doesn't necessarily bring silica dust down to acceptable levels. And this is what they failed to recognize, even though it's in their own data.
Howard Berkus was formerly an investigative reporter for NPR. He recently retired. There's more of that conversation on the Energy Explained podcast, which is produced by State Impact Pennsylvania. You can find a link to the podcast at AlleghenyFront.org. When you're a wildlife conservation officer, your job is to prevent poaching, handle coyote complaints, and keep an eye on turkeys that have gotten very comfortable in urban spaces.
They're eating bird seed along with the squirrel out of the bird feeder.
Oh, they're so happy. Is that you?
Yeah, it was me.
Later on the Allegheny Front, we're on patrol with a local wildlife conservation officer. Stay tuned. Across the United States, more than 2 million people work in energy efficiency. It's the largest sector of the nation's clean energy workforce. Virginia McGrath holds one of those jobs. She's an energy auditor for Pittsburgh's Conservation Consultants Incorporated. And she says the conversation surrounding her work is changing.
The energy efficiency field has made a transition. Instead of saving energy and saving money, we're talking about making a home safer and more comfortable. I think that resonates with people a little bit more.
Last year for State Impact Pennsylvania's Voices of Energy series, McGrath shared her story as she inspected a newly built house.
Hello. There's no one living in this home currently. They're closing, I believe, next week, Wednesday. The builders are having me come in to make sure that all of the energy efficiency installations that they've done are are done well and that they didn't miss anything. Anywhere where wire or plumbing penetrations are coming in, they would want to be air sealed. So these should have a bead of caulk around them. I'm gonna just take a picture. And then you see how there's spray foam on this side, not on this side. So it's just little things like that that I'm looking for. This is just something I'm gonna note, and they might come back and do it, or they might not, we'll see. I really enjoy being able to see the difference that I'm making. So if I go to a home and do an energy audit and recommend that they get insulation or they do these air sealing measures, I get to actually see the difference that it's made in their home. And I know that that's going to save them money, make their home more comfortable, but it's also going to reduce that home's reliance on fossil fuels. So this is probably like a more awkward piece of equipment. This is the blower door. There's a test that I'm gonna do. It's an air leakage test. So we'll be sucking all the air out of the house and then being able to see where air leakage might be coming in. All right, well, let's start it up. To put this in perspective, this home is probably similar size to mine, and my house was built in 1900 though, and I do this for a living, so my house is pretty airtight and it's insulated pretty well, but my blower door rating is like 3200, so almost twice as much as this house. And that's just something it's really hard to get with the older homes, unless you're totally gutting them and redoing them yourself and redoing them with energy efficiency in mind. So I did recently start flipping houses. It's been an adventure. I want to put my knowledge that I have towards energy efficiency into these homes. And I want to make these old, dilapidated Pittsburgh homes as energy efficient as possible.
That was Virginia McGrath. Her story was produced by Amy Sisk for State Impact Pennsylvania. And there's a link to more profiles at AlleghenyFront.org. Another environmental job that you might not know much about is wildlife conservation officer. According to a poll, more than half of Pennsylvanians don't know which agency deals with wildlife in the state. It's the Pennsylvania Game Commission, which manages 480 species of wild birds, mammals, and their habitats. And it's not just in rural areas, as more wildlife moves into urban and suburban spaces. That's where Doug Bergman comes in. He's a wildlife conservation officer, and his district covers most of Allegheny County. A few years ago, producer Andy Cubis spent a morning in the passenger seat of Officer Bergman's truck to learn about what his job is really like.
It's early. It is early.
I just get in the front?
The sun hadn't yet come up when I met up with Officer Doug Bergman in a parking lot on Route 30.
You don't want to put it in the front. I mean, just throw it on top. It'll slide around until it settles in.
Part policeman and part wildlife biologist, Officer Bergman's mobile office is stocked with everything from the Peterson's Field Guide to Bergs to handcuffs. In the middle console is a high-tech setup that includes a full computer monitor.
Plugging air to 418.
Let me explain how this works. Okay, this is our computer aid dispatch. What you're looking at here is my call list. If I click this button, it's going to give you the state call list.
So what's a typical day like for you?
There are no typical days. Today is actually the first day of trout, and eventually I'll start checking trout fishermen here to help the Fish Commission out, but we don't do fish. I like to tell everybody we're warm and fuzzy, they're cold and slimy.
Warm and fuzzy turns out to include turkeys, not an animal I usually think of as especially warm or fuzzy. But this time of year is turkey mating season, so the turkeys are out and about, and Officer Bergman gets a ton of calls about them.
This time of year, the males posture, they strut, they gobble a lot, and they fight. And they're trying to establish dominance so that they're the one that does the breeding.
How do you show your dominance to a turkey?
Take a broom and chase it off your sidewalk.
Arriving at destination on left.
Look out your window. Now, what are they doing? They're eating bird seed along with the squirrel out of the bird feeder.
Oh, they're so happy.
Oh, yeah. Those are two turkeys that have adapted to their surroundings.
Is that you?
Yeah, it was me.
Officer Bergman says wildlife is adapting to urban and suburban areas just fine. It's the humans that generally have the problems.
The Allegheny County District is driven by people complaining about wildlife. I get a lot of small animal complaints. I get a lot of coyote complaints, stuff like that. People don't realize just because it's developed, we have coyotes all through this district. Typically, that's an animal that people might be a little alarmed to see, but we have them here. You got to learn to basically live with that and protect yourself in a manner that allows the coyote to be there.
Besides nuisance calls, Officer Bergman also gets a lot of tips. Calls from people snitching on neighbors who are trying to keep wildlife as pets. He's confiscated raccoons, skunks, hedgehogs, and a lot of sugar gliders.
Sugar gliders are a squirrel-like animal from South America. They're not from here. So if you allow these people to buy the animals, bring them here and release them and get tired of them and turn them loose or whatever, and they should start populating, you know, now you have an animal that's not native, destroying habitat that our native wildlife needs.
Wildlife conservation officers used to be called game wardens, and most of their duties revolved around regulating hunters and going after poachers. That's still a big part of the job, and a dangerous one. In fact, an officer was killed by a poacher in Adams County in 2010. But today, as human development encroaches on wildlife habitats, protecting animals is becoming paramount. Officer Bergman says that he feels like an even mix of enforcer and conservationist, and he's a man who loves his job.
Hands down, greatest job in the world. It's different every day. You get to deal with wildlife and educate people about wildlife. People have to realize that the animals were here first, and through development and whatnot, we've taken away some of their habitats, so they've adapted to us. Pittsburgh is unique in the aspect that within 20 minutes from town, you can be in wild areas. So you get these animals that come up against the city and they learn to adapt to that. It's no wonder that we have an overabundance of just about every animal.
On the Sunday morning I spent with Officer Bergman, not one citizen complaint call came in. Maybe that means, for one weekend at least, the humans and wildlife were getting along just fine.
Ligonier 213.
Go ahead, 213.
Back in the vehicle.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Andy Kubis.
Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. The Sears Sweatland Family Foundation supports our coverage in Ohio. And the Robert F. Schumann Foundation supports our podcast, Trump on Earth. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.